From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
But something happened there when I was lying in the bed, because, you know, they give you opiates and then you don't sleep for days. And then I was like, I want to be a boss. And I remember my ceiling just be like, I'm going to live and I'm going to be a boss. And then it happened.
Soon after Latinx playwright Tanya Saracho got the green light to make a pilot for her first TV series, she contracted a dangerous spinal infection. But Saracho rallied, and her spicy series, Vita, premiered on the Starz channel earlier this year. And she's just started production on a second season. For the holiday weekend, we're revisiting our conversation with Saracho. A former Chicago-based playwright, she tells us about her horrible first experiences as a TV writer and how she ended up running the first all-Latinx writer's room in cable. But first, we banter. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterer, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, big news in terms of NBC News. This has been somewhat of an ongoing story in that we've seen NBC News miss the huge Access Hollywood story, which they had for a long time before the Washington Post broke it. And by a long time, I mean a few days, but in the news business, that is a long time. We've seen them have a scandal with Matt Lauer's conduct, which they then investigated in-house and exonerated themselves. And of course, one of the really big ones also has been the Ronan Farrow, Harvey Weinstein story. So in the past couple of days, two stories ran. I'm going to sort of mix and match the information in both. One of them was in the New York Times. It basically dealt with Rich McHugh, who was the producer working with Ronan Farrow on this Harvey Weinstein expose. And he alleged that NBC interfered with the reporting. Obviously, in the end, the story went to the New Yorker. And then there was a story in the Daily Beast, which had a lot of stuff in it about the interference by NBC News counsel, who allegedly threatened Ronan Farrow if he continued to report the story after taking it elsewhere, which is a crazy allegation. I mean, they deny it. And also things like Noah Oppenheim, the head of NBC News under Andy Lack, he was a screenwriter, and Ronan Farrow at one point became suspicious that he was actually leaking stuff about his investigation to Harvey Weinstein or his associates. So if all of this stuff pans out, and Ronan Farrow, I think, is probably going to release a book sooner rather than later. He hasn't had a date yet, but he's doing one. It's a huge scandal.
It's a horrible scandal for NBC News because despite the repeated statements they keep putting out about how the story was not there, their position is when Ronan Farrow was working on this piece for NBC News, he'd never had a woman accuser who is willing to go on the record and be a credible source in a story that was ready to publish. Now, a lot of people have called BS on that and said that there were people that, at least one, Rose McGowan, has been outed as someone who was willing to go on the record at the time. They were also in possession of the audio tape of the accuser literally negotiating with Harvey Weinstein over what he wanted to do with her. And this, in my professional judgment, would have been newsworthy on its own. But their position is story wasn't ready. It went elsewhere. They were bummed they lost it, but they can't be held accountable for this. And I think the more this stuff dribbles out, the more they are going to be held accountable. And at some point, I think there's going to be a regime change there.
I think the regime change will be sooner rather than later. I think Andy Lack is not going to be able to hold on to his job much longer. You know, he has been part and parcel of this and other bad decisions. You know, the Megyn Kelly, they spend a lot of money to bring her in, and it's not proving to be worth it. In terms of the story not being ready, as a journalist, I find that to be a particularly ridiculous argument, because many times in life, like every week, pretty much, you send a story to your editor and the editor says, you know, I don't know if it's quite there yet. Do this, do that, do the other thing. That's called journalism. That's normal. So this story that it wasn't ready is absolutely lame. And of course, that was proven when he went on and published it in The New Yorker, and it was ready. The other thing I'll mention, you know, we had this experience at The Hollywood Reporter with Sylai Abrams, who told us about two assaults. She alleged that Russell Simmons had raped her. These were over a period of years. And then 12 years later, she alleged that AJ Calloway, a host on Extra, had sexually assaulted her. And she went through months and months of vetting with NBC, with MSNBC at that point, because Joy Reid was doing the story. And as it happens, she's a woman who keeps extensive documentation of everything in her life and had a lot of witnesses who she had talked to at the time that these two assaults, again, 12 years apart, allegedly occurred. So they took Sylai Abrams through these months and months, and then they dropped the story after vetting and vetting and vetting, and again, they invoked the general counsel as being part of that decision-making to Cilei Abrams, we turned around, we reported it, and we published. So that's another one where NBC News looked like they took a big fat ball and dropped it.
Yeah, and I'm curious about the role that the legal executives are having here, because we've now seen a number of instances, both with the Ronan Farrow situation, where there's an allegation that the lawyer stepped in and threatened him. There's the Cilei Abrams allegation that the lawyers were very involved in this. Then there's the overarching issue with NBC having investigated itself with both its general counsel of NBC Universal and the general counsel of NBC News being very involved and not hiring these outside investigators that often other companies have done. You know, lawyers are involved in vetting journalism at every level. And, you know, we deal with that here at Hollywood Reporter. But the lawyer ultimately is charged with making a recommendation about the risks involved in a story. I don't know an instance where the lawyer would have got involved to the extent where they're saying to a reporter, do not take this story elsewhere. That, to me, if true, and we, you know, it's been reported, that would cross a bunch of different lines. And I would like to know more about what actually happened there.
I think that maybe Ronan will drop his book, as I said, sooner rather than later. And then, you know, looking forward at NBC News, I certainly don't see how Andy Lack survives. And with the allegation that Noah Oppenheim may have been leaking, I don't know where does this end and where does this, how high level? There are several comments that this was at the highest level. So does that mean the general counsel or does that mean somewhere else?
Or does it mean someone even higher than Andy Lack at Comcast or NBC Universal?
Exactly. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The Starz series Vita follows two sisters, Emma and Lynn Hernandez, who come home to L.A.'s Boyle Heights neighborhood after the death of their mother. They soon discover that the late Vidalia had some big secrets, including the fact that she'd been married for the past 2 years to a woman. Younger sister Lynn, played by Melissa Barrera, takes this news in stride, while chilly older sister Emma, played by Michelle Prada, is furious, partially because their mother's relationship affects their inheritance.
Listen to this. Vidalia has left us the building. But we have to split it three ways.
Three ways?
Mm-hmm.
With the wife?
Yep.
I mean, I guess that makes sense.
Over my dead body.
Vita was created by our guest today, Tanya Saracho, a playwright who ran a theater group in Chicago before moving to L.A. 5 years ago. You're a showrunner. You're a first-time showrunner.
First time, yeah.
Do you read the reviews?
Yeah, I do. I used to do that for theater stuff, and they were like, don't read your reviews. And my reviews in theater were mixed. There was always some kind of racial thing that they would say, like, mamacita.
You know? Oh, somebody
yeah.
said that?
Yep.
That is so wrong.
Or, like, this play is basically like Sexo in the Windy Ciudad, Sex in the
oh,
City, but Sex in the Windy
City.
Ciudad. Okay. And it's like, why do they have to, like, it's kind of because you're racializing it, you
right.
know?
Why are you comparing it to
so,
a thing
like,
that's
I've always yeah. been ready for reviews like that, and it hasn't been like that for this, and I'm, like, just still waiting for them to come back.
I think people, from what I've read, they're just really excited that Starz is trying to
yeah.
do something like this.
And
right?
they are doing it. They're putting all their heft behind it, you know? When we had the writers room production, like, it's always been like, yes, yes. Like, they're ready to say yes for this first season. And I hope I don't get used to it because it was not, I'm not going to say it's easy because any show is not easy, you know? But like.
That part was easy.
Yeah. I wanted all Latinx writers. Yes, of course. I wanted all female department heads. Yes, of course. Like. It's been amazing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, setting aside the merits of your show, what is that about, do you think?
Well, I don't know if this is real, but from my perspective, Marta Fernandez is my covering executive.
She's the exec, right.
So I have someone in the castle. You know, I don't have to storm it. I don't have to sneak into it. I don't have to, like, you know, beg to be there. She's, like, inviting me in and protecting me at every part. We've become like sisters now. I really love her. And I know it sounds like Pollyanna and cheesy, but I've never experienced anything like that.
I mean, the one thing, looking at it through the cold eye of a business person who might ask a question, it's, of course, everybody's desperately trying to reach a
Oh, yeah. They had six. When I got there, I was one of six projects.
One of,
Latinx-themed or Latinx gays.
You're going to have to help me with terminology.
But Latinx is like Latino, but we're taking away gender.
Right.
It's gender inclusive.
So it means
it's
everybody.
It's not patriarchal. Yes.
Because I wasn't sure if there's a sexuality element to it.
Well, it's to taking away gender. So a non-binary Latinx person, you can say this too.
But going back to the Latin.
Latinx. So yeah.
Everybody wants that audience. That audience loves entertainment.
Oh, we consume, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Film and TV.
You know, a lot of things that have been engineered to be like specifically for that audience didn't really work. And there was a time I wrote a story, this was years ago, and people were saying, people in that community, in the Latinx community, they don't want something formulated for them. You know, they want to be part of whatever the mainstream culture is into, and that's why it's not working. That was the takeaway when I reported that story a long time ago.
I think it's been different waves of things, right? Like, because we haven't been seen at each decade. Mm-hmm. Like, we get a little try. We got La Bamba. We got seen as Chicanos, and then what happened, right? Or we're seen through a point of view that is not ours. We're like, we're Scarface. What? And then,
Thank you, but no.
But then, like, every decade, there are some big attempts. I don't have the answer. I just know that I think sometimes we try to swallow up the whole world or all of culture and be like, okay, this is the immigrant narrative. And you can't do that because we're 27 countries that make up the Latin diaspora. How are you going to do that? There's a whole thing. So I just leaned into the specificity of this world, this slang, this style of Spanglish. And it's not the same as Cuban Spanglish from Miami or New Rican Spanglish from Brooklyn or Bronx. So, like, I feel like maybe that's the way in, and also telling the second generational American story, because it's an American story that I'm telling.
So if you were trying to do that, reach out and get that audience, but you're picking a show that has a lot of characters who are either gay or you talked about...
Oh, Top Femme.
Top Femme with a person that was non-binary?
They were having sex with a non-binary person.
Yes, okay. Yeah. But what I'm wondering is, what I'm trying to get to is... And yet they go forward, even though I would think in the whole, can I still say Latino?
Say whatever you want. Yeah.
Latino community, in the whole Latino community, you know, I don't know that is so accepted, right? That's a big deal.
Well, I'm queer and I'm Latinx and I'm steeped in that. So, you know, I just sort of wrote from my perspective. And then my writer's room is mostly queer and Latina, and so we wrote it for
this is maybe more a question for stars,
sure,
honestly.
Yeah.
Like, why do you choose this if you want to broaden to a huge number of that audience? I just think it shows that they must have really liked it or...
Yeah, because like, you know, the assignment was when they brought me in and I thought I was interviewing for a gig, like a writing gig, like, because I'd been here 3 years and I had just left How to Get Away with Murder. And, you know, she presented me with this like, yeah, this show, have you heard of gentrification? Oh, I haven't heard of that term. Gentrification.
Being gentrification.
Of, you know, gentrification of Latinx space by upwardly mobile Latinx, you know? Oh my God, that's fascinating. Great. We want a show that is about Latina millennials in East LA, about gentrification, chipsters. Can you do it?
Chipsters being
Chicano hipsters.
Chicano hipsters, okay.
And I was like, I can do it.
They literally asked you for that.
It was that
specific.
But also broad because...
Right. Because within that world, it can be whatever it is.
And it is.
Right.
You know, they didn't say queer. You know, they didn't say there's a non-binary sex scene. But everything I would turn in, they were like, yes, and. Yes,
you're
and.
Like, damn, they
kept saying, well, no, they were like, we're Prime Cable. So bring us Prime Cable. Okay. I'm a watcher of Stars. I'm obsessed with Outlander, which is not like the show, but it is because it's like complicated women at the center.
Right.
So this is a star show.
Right.
Know?
So you, let's roll back. You were a playwright.
Yeah.
And you were born in Mexico, but grew up in the, in Texas, basically.
I grew up in my childhood in Mexico. And then around 12, 13, I went to Texas. And it was like Mexico, but light and clean, you know? But it was like same air, same temperature from the town 10 minutes over that we used to live in. It was so porous too in the 90s. You know, you could go in and out, forget your passport, and just be...
Those days are...
No, it's so different now than when we grew up.
Yeah, really different.
Yes.
So you decide to move to Chicago, I think because it's a vibrant theater scene, right?
Yes.
Very vibrant.
I was a Boston University, and it was that last year when everyone's deciding we're all going to New York, right? And I had been to New York in the weekends to visit friends, and they lived in shoeboxes and had to have three jobs, and they walked, and there was no supermarkets, and I like to eat, as you can tell. And I'm like, wait a minute, I don't want to be walking around all the time not eating and having three jobs and not doing theater, because it took people a while to get. And I was like, I wanted to start a theater company too. Chicago, you know, Steppenwolf, right. Looking Glass. That's where the
amazing
theater. So, and it worked. You know, I started a company and of all Latinas, which, see, there's a theme here, you know.
I did notice the theme. Yeah.
And some people, you know, some Latinx writers are like, I don't want to be pigeonholed. I like being identified as a Latina writer. I'm proud of it. I think I will never get tired of telling our stories. And there's so many stories. So like, I don't feel pigeonholed yet, you know.
So you write plays and then you decide, I think an agent saw one of your plays.
Yeah, I was
right?
in New York doing a play at a like 49-seat theater or something. I thought I was like, I've arrived. It was my first play in New York. And I guess he got a hold of Mala Hierba, which is this play that had been making the rounds. Everybody had read it, but nobody would be like, we'll produce it, you know? But it opened a lot of doors in TV. It's like...
It was your spec script that you didn't know.
Yeah, I didn't know it because it was a play. And then he like... found me, and he was like, you could write for TV. And I was like, that's not a thing that I've ever thought about, you know?
Did you go like you?
No, I just never, nobody had heard of UTA, UTA, which I thought was called UTA,
UTA.
Forever, because that's what it says on
not,
the email.
Not UTA. Ka, or no, like, I can't do WME that way. You could do well, Ka and UTA.
And WME, WME, no, I don't know.
Right.
But that's UTA but... who found me. And then he said, he was like, just come to LA and take meetings. And I was like, what, do I have to train? Do I have to do a course? No, just do this. I was like, eat your steak that you're giving me at this fancy.
I will eat your steak.
I will eat the steaks, you know. But like, yeah, I was doing a play at the Fountain Theater, another small
not-for-profit
theater here in LA. And I was like, I will take advantage of that. And while I'm in rehearsal, I will go do these meetings. And then a job came from that.
Coming up after a short break, Tanya Saracho tells us about the unexpected blowback she faced while filming a Vida sizzle reel on location in LA's Boyle Heights neighborhood. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're revisiting our conversation with Tanya Saracho, showrunner of the series Vida on Starz. Vida is a family story. It follows two sisters, Emma and Lynn Hernandez, who return to LA's Boyle Heights neighborhood after their mother dies. The sisters find that the East LA they grew up in is in the process of being gentrified, to a large extent by upwardly mobile Latinos. In Vida, Chelsea Rendon plays Marisol, an anti-gentrification community firebrand with an active video blog. The Hernandez sisters run into her as she confronts some white hipsters Instagramming outside a local restaurant, singing the praises of its birria, or goat stew. Emma tries to intervene, but Marisol is not having it.
What did you, gringas? Keep it moving. First of all, I'm not a gringa, so you. Second, you don't tell me where I can go.
Not here.
What did you just say to me? Why are you being such a bully? Who are you calling a bully? I'm out here defending my neighborhood, all right? Have you even considered that maybe this birria restaurant could use the business? When was the last time you went in there and bought a plate of birria?
No, you didn't with that vendida logic.
Oh, what is this you doing, Chola 101?
Showrunner Tanya Saracho says Starz has given her a lot of freedom with Vida, much different from her first TV writing job on the Lifetime show, Devious Maids.
With the Devious Maids job. That I didn't understand. I didn't know who Mark Cherry was. Like that I was.
You never watched Desperate Housewives?
No,
you just didn't
and
connect.
I didn't know that it was a showrunner interview, that I should have like been in my best behavior. I was just like, all the other meetings.
Right.
Which was probably the best for the best because I didn't know to be nervous, you know? But then that first day of work, and it was like, oh my gosh, there's no writing in TV writing. It's all pitching. It's horrible. It's
like
the
selling
worst.
Your idea.
And being witty and being who's the wittiest. And I'm not like that.
It just was a shock.
This is horrible.
Culture shock in the
outline.
Artistic sense.
Yeah, all of it. I'd never seen Final Draft in my life, you know?
Yeah.
Oh.
And you didn't write your plays that way.
No. And I like you know, by the end of that job, I was like, oh, wait, TV writing is rendering content when you're a hired gun, you know?
Right. Did somebody say something to you at Devious Maids?
Oh, yes.
You know where I'm going with mm-hmm. this. Tell me that story.
It was the first hour of my first day of television. One of my coworkers, he turns to me and he's really tall and I'm a short Mexican, you know, and he like tall and looks down at me and he goes, you do know you're the diversity hire, right? And I'm like, what's that? Like an idiot. And he goes, oh, honey. I was like, what? And I called my Uta, you know, and I was like, Uta, what the hell? What is diversity hire? And I was like, oh, I didn't want to tell you so I didn't get in your head. Is it supposed to get in my head? Do I have a job here? Am I on probation? Like, what is diversity hire? It just means you don't cost the room anything. You don't cost the show anything.
Because they're not paying out of their budget.
So am I a writer?
Right.
And that's what I sort of battled with.
This is where the studio is paying to try to do something. We're not quite sure what they were trying to do yet.
You know, from the top, it's a good idea at the top, but the way it gets administered in practice, it becomes problematic because you have things like this. You know, I know so many Latinx TV writers that kept repeating the diversity hire position because the second year, you cost the show. In practice,
you could go for quite a while.
Four times, somebody I know. So last year, I had this position and I said, we will never refer to this position as diversity hire. This is the funded position. From now on, we talk about the funded position.
That's a good thing. So then you went from ultimately, I think, looking to how to get away with murder.
Yeah.
Which seems, did you deliberately think, I want to work for a big tent network show?
No, I never think anything. Nothing I've ever done.
Yeah.
Has been thought out. Everything's like, yes, and to the universe. Looking had gotten, unfortunately,
canceled.
So after that, I was working with J.C. Lee, another writer, on Looking. I don't know how we both ended up on How to Get Away with Murder together. I never thought I was going to do network. I don't feel like
you're a network.
Yeah, because I'm horrible at plot. If you watch my show, there's nothing ever happens. just like I'm Looking.
Yes,
nothing ever happens.
All the publicists are going, is she promoting her show or trying to kill
it
now?
It's awesome. Things happen, but it's not a plot heavy, like, and then this happened.
Right. It's not that narrative drive.
It's more internal, you know.
Yeah.
It's a character
like
half hour.
A whodunit or a closed procedural or any of that stuff. Yeah.
And so I ended up on the show, a learning experience that I was terrible at story and plot.
So is it just a total...
But it was so lovely because there was 9 writers and 6 of us were of color. It was Shondaland.
Right.
So you're like, oh, wait, this can be done. And that was the first time that I had all those POCs, you know?
Right.
So like, I was like, wait, I could do something like this, you know? So it was great. I mean, like, I learned so much from Murder, but I don't know how much I contributed. I love Pete and we're still friends, like the showrunner. But then I had to tell him, I was like, I have to go. I'm dead weight here, you know? And then 3 days later was my meeting with Stars. So it was like, it just happened.
It happened the way it was meant to happen, I guess. So then when you started with Stars, you had a problem with your disc. You had to have surgery.
Oh, yeah. And they didn't realize how bad it was till I was like later, by the way, I almost died. So like, they sort of pitched it to me. And then I said, yes, look, I would do this. This is what I would do with the world, you know, sort of like
the toss back.
Look, this is what I would do with it. And it was like, great, fantastic. Okay, I'm going to Scotland tomorrow because my boyfriend lives in Scotland. I'm queer. I have a boyfriend.
I'm saying there. People are like, what? Because people are, I'm just going to stop momentarily. Are people upset about that? Like, you are supposed to represent this.
No, I do. I have a boyfriend, but I've been with trans people, cis people, male, female. I'm fluid. So
you're fluid.
Yeah, I guess you could say I'm bisexual, but I think there's more than 2 genders. So right. I say I'm queer.
So back to your back. Back to the back.
Oh, yes. I had a microdiscectomy, but then I got a spinal infection from it.
Infection,
from the hospital, you know, the operation. And that was crazy. Six months it took. And this cis male Scott quit his job and came for 6 months to take care of me. But like, I couldn't even go to the bathroom myself, feed myself. Like, anyway, it was really hard. But then while I was recovering those 6 months, that was the 6 months of development, sort of like the big chunks where you turn in your outline and then you turn in your pilot, you know?
Yes.
It was all phone calls and emails. So I was like Frida Kahlo on a bed. Like, the outline I wrote with one hand, there was a catheter from the middle of my arm to my heart for the infection. 2 months it took to get it out. But something happened there when I was lying in the bed, because, you know, they give you opiates and then you don't sleep for days. Like, and then I was like, I want to be a boss. I'm going to be a boss. And I remember my ceiling just be like, I'm going to live and I'm going to be a boss. And then it happened. You know, like, I'm not saying it was good, but it did something.
It clarified something.
Yeah, because I was like, not reluctantly here, but I was like, I'm a guest here in TV. Yes, I'll work for some rooms, but really the theater is my thing. But something happened that I was like, I want to do this thing right. And then it just sort of,
your
like
spirit,
my,
your spirit yeah. animal came yeah. to you.
You're like, you, Simba, will wake up from this bed. And we're, yeah, something like that.
So, okay, if I recall correctly, there was some blowback in terms you in coming into the, you didn't even shoot in Boyle Heights.
Which we did shoot a pilot presentation, right. a 15 minute, and that's when we got the blowback. Yeah.
Yes, that was kind of your...
That was my pilot.
Your
pilot.
Like,
but it was like a 15 minute, 2 day shoot. You know, thing that was so informational and great. And like, I'd been on set as a writer, but not, you know, running the show. And so right. it was great training wheels for me. What it did do is that it didn't get a good reaction, especially online. And I was surprised.
What was the reaction?
Well, because I'm not from Boyle Heights. I'm not from the
and
east side.
And online, you mean like people just on social media? Mm-hmm. Nobody saw what you were shooting. They just saw that
shooting. I mean, I took pictures on set and, you know, just like, we're shooting here. Also, there were trucks there on 7th, you know, and they were in the way. It's a small neighborhood, you know, like,
yeah. So your trucks were blocked, in the way.
Yeah.
And people knew you were doing something that was Hollywood.
What are they doing?
Something.
And then right. they discovered online, what is it like? I don't know how they did, you know, sometimes the name of the production is on the side of the
right.
trucks. They, by 11 a.m., we had started at 7 a.m., they were like, protesting us, and I was not prepared for this, and I'm in a way not glad, but I'm grateful for the discussion, because the discussion is this show, you know, because about gentrification, and I was sort of embodying that, you know.
Right, there was some name they called you.
Oh yes, a white tina
that's
and a coconut
name. A coconut brown on the outside, white yeah. inside. Mm-hmm. Right,
I was like, you don't know my work in Chicago, all my work, you know, but then it didn't matter. It was not about like me being Latina or Mexican. It was that I'm not from this neighborhood, not or from this area, you know. And the conversation just yielded a lot of conversations on our side. So when we did get picked up, I said, we cannot spend too much time in the area because of our trucks, you know. So like, we film whatever we have to, just like
quick in, quick out.
To respect their opinion, because they're right. It does become this big force when Hollywood sort of arrives in these neighborhoods, you know? We checked out what neighborhood would be friendly, and we found Pico Union around Koreatown to be friendly to, like, yeah, come. So we gutted a 99-cent store and put a bar in there.
To be clear, the bar was the set of the Mother's
yes.
Bar, but go ahead.
Yes.
Not a real bar.
And then also we engaged with the community. We had a community liaison that would bring people to our writer's room, or we would go, you know, visit non-for-profits and talk to people, talk to street vendors, stuff like that, because we wanted to be really informed and do this right.
Well, is that what White Tina is about, that they're afraid you're going to make some kind of stereotypical bad representation?
Sure, yeah. It's a proximity to whiteness, which is selling out, you know?
And it's almost like you can't necessarily win that game without anything to show it yet.
And even now, I'm not trying to win it, you know, because we still have to take our trucks in there, you know? I'm just trying to be as respectful as I can and try and hopefully, if they see the show and be like, oh, okay, she's doing this right.
Tanya Saracho is the creator of Vida on Stars. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.